From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with playwrights William Hoffman and Larry Kramer. Their plays As Is and The Normal Heart explore the physical, emotional, and political ramifications of AIDS. Also today, filmmaker Jill Godmilow talks about switching from documentaries to feature films. Her new movie is based on the lives of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. Folk singer Michael Cooney will play new versions of a couple of old favorites. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Talk Radio, the new play by performance artist Eric Bogosian. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guests are playwrights Larry Kramer and William M. Hoffman. Kramer wrote the play The Normal Heart. Hoffman wrote the play As Is. They were two of the first and two of the most highly regarded plays to deal with AIDS. As is a tragedy laced with comedy that explores how AIDS and the fear of AIDS affects not only sexual relationships, but also relationships with friends and family. The Normal Heart takes a more political approach. It condemns the medical community and the government for their slow response and criticizes gays for their reluctance to change their sexual behavior. As Is won the 1985 Drama Desk Award as the year's best play. William Hoffman is now at work on a screenplay about the life of Harvey Milk, and he just finished the libretto for an opera commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera. Larry Kramer is the author of the novel Faggots and wrote the screenplay for the movie Women in Love, the adaptation of the D.H. Lawrence novel. Kramer is also co-founder of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, one of the first groups to organize in response to AIDS. I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Let me start by asking you about the writing of your plays. You both got started on your plays before the AIDS epidemic grew to the magnitude it has now, before we really comprehended what the magnitude was going to be. William Hoffman, were there incidents in your life that triggered the writing of As Is?
Yes, the very first article in the New York Times triggered it originally, sometime in 1980, 81, I don't even know anymore, before there was a word for AIDS, and before there was a word, even grid, and eventually the death of, I was a long-distance runner and priding myself on, I wasn't going to get AIDS because I was a long-distance runner and I was taking a lot of vitamin C or something like that. And then my best running buddy died of AIDS, and I just realized that I was vulnerable and fell into a deep depression, and I to work out of that depression, I wrote As Is, completed As Is.
But you, Larry
Kramer. Work?
Yes.
Yes, you're no longer depressed.
Less depressed.
Less depressed. I think we knew from the very beginning what was happening, so I don't think it's fair to say before anybody knew what was happening. I think this epidemic has been utterly predictable from day one, and exactly what a number of us said was going to happen has happened, and no one listened then and no one is listening now.
What do you think you've said in your play about what was going to happen that has come true?
Well, that it's going to get worse and worse and worse, and that nobody's going to pay any attention to it. And that I think that still holds true, that despite all of the media attention, none of that media attention is manifesting itself into action at the top. By that I mean actual research and science, not all of this red herring talk about mandatory testing and sex education in the schools and condom on TV. All of that is just nonsense. It keeps everybody's mind off of the all-out war that must be waged scientifically and research-wise, and which is not being done, even though the government has appropriated masses of dollars, those dollars are not being spent.
It seems extraordinary after all this time. That's all the president can talk about is testing, no compassion, no...
Just so everyone will think he's doing
testing,
something.
As if testing is going to do anything. It gives people the dangerous illusion that they might be safe through testing, which is crazy. Just delusionary thinking.
William Hoffman, when you wrote your play, a good friend of yours had died of AIDS.
The first, right? I have a number of good friends. Yeah.
But this meant, writing the play meant you had to really immerse yourself in the subject just at a time when you might have really wanted to repress it or try to get away from it for a while. Was it hard to go that deeply into it?
I hated it. I thought I would get AIDS by thinking about it. And it was some kind of magical thinking, which I think is kind of ordinary. I think it's most people's reaction to AIDS is if you look at somebody with AIDS, you can get it, or think about it, you can get it. It's very strange and superstitious, but I think most people, including me, operate on a very superstitious level. Yes, it was painful, and I'm glad I didn't.
Larry Kramer, in your play, you're critical of the medical profession, critical of the government for not working quickly enough and hard enough to get research that would... Yeah.
I don't think I'm so critical of the medical profession. I think I'm more critical of the political community for not realizing what was happening. I'm critical of the media for taking such a blastedly long time to write about it with any effectiveness. If you compared with let's take the Tylenol scare, which lasted all of 3 months and in which there were only a total of 7 deaths, 1 month alone, the New York Times had 54 articles about Tylenol. I mean, that's the kind of attention that stops something in its tracks. In the first 1,000 cases of AIDS, the New York Times had written 7 articles, and that's over something like 15, 18 months. Now, that's a pretty awful track record. I'm also, and still am, very angry at the gay community for being so politically weak and not fighting to save its own life.
Well, let me quote something that one of your main characters says in The Normal Heart. He says, "When are we going to admit we might be spreading this? We've sexed ourselves silly for years and years. Sometimes we've done it in the filthiest places." You were really, I think, criticized by a lot of gays for comments like that, for blaming the gay community for the spread of AIDS, and for a lot of people said that you were coming out against sex.
Well, I think it says more about you than it does about me that in my entire play, that's the one line you should have picked out. The play is a concatenation of many arguments from all different sides, presenting that argument as well as the reverse argument. And again, I think it is unfair of you to have chosen that line. A virus lands in a community. It doesn't choose a community. It just lands there. And it spreads. There are those of us who felt that it was very important very early on to talk about stopping having sex, just like people are now saying that that's what has to be done or that much safer measures have to be taken. And this particular character is advocating that.
Okay. William Hoffman, your play takes a very humorous approach in a way. It's a comedy of sorts. It's a comedy.
I think that my characters have humor, but I don't think it's in any sense a comedy. No, I was drawing portraits from life, mm-hmm. and a lot of the people I know who are dealing well. You can't deal well with dying, but people who were not falling apart spiritually were using. Humor. We're laughing. We're having as a way of gaining perspective. And I also got that from my father, who was dying at that time, not of AIDS. But and I noticed that I who was filled with so much self-pity, had no sense of humor at the time. And I was learning from something from people who were really much worse off than I. And that's why the play is laced with humor. I wanted perspective, and you get perspective through humor.
Did you go through a period ever of thinking, well, jokes don't belong in this, and
no.
I shouldn't be doing comic portrayals
of
characters at all?
I never did that. I felt I was doing portraits from life. I felt obligated to draw the way I saw it, and I loved it, and I knew it was the right thing to do. And I never had any doubts about the humor. I had doubts about a lot of things, but not about the humor.
What did you have doubts about?
I didn't know how expositional, how much information about AIDS should go in the play, because I was writing at a time when no one knew anything. You know, there was a lot of information to get across, and I didn't know how much. You know, some audiences members, some of the gay guys would know an enormous amount, and some of the people would know nothing, and I didn't know where to draw a line. We finally just asked our audience to fill out comment cards, and we figured out through their comments how much we had to put in. And it was really hard. I had a lot of doubts.
Were you ever both worried at all that, you know, who's going to spend their money on their Saturday night out to see something about AIDS? Your show started off-Broadway, which is, I think, different from Broadway. I think people take a much more open-minded and broader view of the theater off Broadway. It's not as, you know, total entertainment oriented. But were you ever concerned that it would be hard to find backers for something about AIDS? Seriously.
Well, my play was turned down by every leading theatrical agent in New York. So.
Beyond worry, then.
Look, when you write plays, it was so totally hopeless that by that point,
I think you just, if you believe enough in what you're doing, and you have to, you know, part of writing a play is also going out there and flogging it. And if your passion is strong enough to make you write it, your passion should be strong enough to get it on somehow if you can. And I sometimes get upset when writers sort of don't have that extra energy to go out and do something once they finish something, as if somehow miraculously it's going to happen by itself.
Neither of us is particularly aloof.
Let's put it that way.
Right. Well, speaking of passion, I think one of the things you both want to do in your plays is to really motivate people to take some kind of action, and also I think to have people feel empathy.
I don't think that's what I was trying to do. I let Larry speak for himself, but I wasn't trying to get people to do anything. I'm not against doing that, but that isn't what I was doing. I believe in propaganda, I like propaganda. I think there's a great tradition of propaganda in the theater. That just happens to be not to be what I was doing in this particular case. I was just trying to do portraits. Now, that if it has a social effect, I'm proud of it. I love it. That isn't what I set out to do.
Oh, who remembers back that far? You sit down and you write what comes out, and there's nothing in the play that didn't happen in one shape or another, and it became really just an attempt to record with as much honesty and fidelity to the emotional truth of all of that, what actually had happened. So I lived all those times, and I wanted to report them along the way. You want people to cry because it's the saddest thing that I've ever known and will ever have to know. And you want people to pay attention. And I think you really want to change the world. I think every writer probably secretly wants to do something like that. But I think we've all had enough experience to know that we can't.
I was motivated partly by the murder of my family during the Holocaust. Between 50 and 200 people were murdered in Latvia and Poland in my family. And I knew one of my goals was to not be silent. And that was my action in this case, was that I was furious at the Germans and the nice little Russians, nice little Latvians for not saying anything. And I figured I could not say nothing. And so I wanted to speak up. And in that sense, I was being political. And I was very, very conscious all the time of the murder of my family, all the time. Thought of it night and day. I thought more of the murder of my family than sometimes of AIDS.
That makes me so mad. Again, that leads into exactly how I feel about the gay community now, where everybody's being very nice and not getting out there and fighting and yelling and organizing. And there are many comparisons in my play to just what Billy is talking about, to how the Jews behaved in America, particularly in the 30s, where they just looked the other way while all of this was happening to them and theirs. I'm beginning to think that the gay community in this country has a death wish. That they're simply allowing, by their own passivity, we are colluding in our own genocide, because I do truly think that genocide is going on now of gay people and black people and Hispanics and drug-using people and prostitutes, groups of people that the right wing and the religious right are very happy to have no longer around. And when it starts happening to white bread people, that's when the government will do something, and not until.
Larry Kramer, you've been an activist for years in this area. And I'm wondering, what do you think are the effective ways of fighting against a virus, or of fighting for something that will help find a solution to fight against a virus?
I don't consider myself an activist. And strangely enough, I will probably surprise everyone that I don't consider myself a political person, whereas I'm probably the most political person in the world. I'm just a person who has very strong opinions and who is living in the middle of wartime and perceive a great many wrongs that are going on and want them addressed. That's what democracy is all about, screaming out when you're stuck with a pin and need help. I've got carried away here and lost sight of your question.
Oh, about effective ways to organize. I mean, you criticized a lot of people for not speaking up.
Politicians only understand one thing, pressure. It is as simple as that. If you don't apply it, you don't get anything. And the gay community gets nothing because it applies no pressure. Pressure comes from organization. It comes from large mailing lists like the National Rifle Association has and like Jerry Falwell has. It's adding your name to a list.
That's not happening.
It's adding your name to a list. It's sending in contributions like all these Bible programs get millions and millions of dollars. Gay organizations have very few thousands of members. They have no money. The gay community is the stingiest community in the world when it comes to giving money to their own organizations, to joining their own organizations, to these organizations working well with each other, coordinating, having lobbying efforts in Washington. Just all the lessons that the Jews learned have to learn through AIDS.
It's odd that the gay community right now is getting more organized on about AIDS. In many, many communities all over the country, gay people are very organized in terms of AIDS self-help groups, Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York, Shanti Project in San Francisco, but yet it has not yet translated. This kind of organization has not yet translated itself in terms of pressure groups, political pressure, which is vital.
By the system that they've, the system that they were formed to make accountable. And I'm often said how wonderful Gay Men's Health Crisis is in New York. Well, yes, it is. But when you think that there are 1 million gay people in New York and Gay Men's Health Crisis has 700 volunteers, big deal. And a lot of those are straight. You know, where are the other 950 blah, blah, thousand.
So you think there needs to be more effective lobbying and also
absolutely
more effective fundraising?
I mean, for example, this is outrageous, the idea right now of testing that it should go out and be broadcast and these ideas being bandied about and there aren't huge protests is unbelievable.
We're walking into our own gas chambers.
Unbelievable.
I want to get back to that in a minute. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be back and talk some more. My guests are playwrights William Hoffman and Larry Kramer. Kramer wrote the play The Normal Heart. Hoffman wrote the play As Is, and they're two of the first and two of the most highly regarded plays on the AIDS epidemic. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are playwrights William Hoffman and Larry Kramer. You were both talking before about how you think that there needs to be more organizing, more fundraising.
Absolutely.
And just last week there was a demonstration in Washington, D.C., in which...
We were both there.
Were you both there? 64?
Ringleaders.
Okay, 64
You're
people.
Looking at the two people who started booing Ronald Reagan first.
Yeah.
64 people got arrested who were blocking traffic.
I'm one of those.
You
I
got arrested?
There,
and
was.
So you were arrested by policemen wearing rubber gloves mm-hmm. to protect themselves mm-hmm. against the AIDS virus. What did you think of them wearing rubber gloves?
I'm going to fool you and say it didn't bother me as much as it bothered everybody else. The Centers for Disease Control, that inept organization that is supposed to monitor diseases in this country, has in fact put out guidelines for healthcare workers and people handling people that they should wear rubber gloves, so that the police in Washington were basically just following instructions by doing it. There were a number of AIDS people there. It was a hot day. If one of the policemen had an open sore or something like that, then it is a not insensible precaution. We were treated exceedingly well in prison. I guess they're used to all those protesters. Again, what made me angry, we got wonderful media attention, and I'm exceedingly grateful for that. But there were only 300 of us. And if in this entire country, the gay community can only rouse 300 people to march in protest against the president's AIDS policies in front of the White House, that shows you what I, more concretely than any of my my rhetoric, what we're up against.
I think what it also shows is the terror in the gay community of asserting itself. It's total stark raving terror of self-assertion. And I think this has to be addressed. And I think this is at the root of it.
I don't agree with Billy on all of this. I don't know what the reason is, but 24 million people can't all be terrified.
There gotta
be,
they are.
There can't, there've got to be more than 300 who have the courage not to be terrified.
Well, there's a lot at stake, I think, for people going to a demonstration about AIDS. A, people might assume that you're gay, and if you're not, if you are gay and you're there and you're not out of the closet, you might feel very
but millions of people are out
intimidated
of the
by that. And then
now.
The other thing is that people might assume you have AIDS or test positive. You might be nervous about that. There's just a
My
lot of assumptions.
Woman,
that
we are into the beginning of the seventh year of the epidemic. These excuses no longer are valid. We all have tens, hundreds of friends who have died. I no longer will accept the excuse of terror, of closetedness, of homophobia. We have made a virtue out of being victims for so long.
I think you're right, Larry. I have no disagreement with it. I think the only reason why I bring up the fear is that to overcome it, we have to understand it. And the point is to go on beyond it, to act in the face of the fear, not to give in to the fear.
Well, but again, I say that some people are fearful, mm-hmm. but 24 million people aren't all fearful, mm-hmm. that you can't use the same excuse.
Laziness
for
is not a good explanation either.
I think there are thousands of excuses. Mm-hmm. I think that we are brought up to be good little boys and girls in this country. We are brought up not to make waves. We think the system is going to take care of us. We think that the National Institutes of Health is so blessedly wonderful that they're going to do everything without our telling them to. We think that our elected mm-hmm. representatives are going to do things without our telling them to. All of these things, in addition to fear, in addition to being treated badly, whatever, plus our own inexperience.
Whatever it is, people do have to take more action. Whatever.
No question. Yeah.
You both made the analogy before to the Holocaust, that the AIDS epidemic and seeing people dying.
I have to be very clear. Yeah. I have to be very clear about this. The AIDS epidemic is not the Holocaust. I don't think that in the slightest. What, in my experience, is I have only two experiences where I have lots of people missing in my life. That's AIDS and the Holocaust. That does not mean that I think that people are promulgating AIDS as they promulgated the Holocaust. I do not think that at all.
I think it entirely.
We
I
don't
do
agree.
Think it is our. I think it is our Holocaust, and I think that if you look at those 8 years between 1933 and 1941, while everyone was saying, "Oh, nothing is happening; it's going to get better," these are these very precious years, the same precious years we are living through now. That if we took action, it wouldn't become what happened in 1941, which is going to happen to us beginning in 1991.
I think because none of us have ever lived through an epidemic like this.
This is ordinary in human history.
But not in the recent past.
In the recent past, it's ordinary. We had syphilis, epidemic syphilis, until what year? 1941 or whatever, until sulfa drugs. We had the 1919 flu epidemic, which killed 20 million people. Epidemics are ordinary facts of human history. What is extraordinary is that we thought that we had gone beyond it, and we were exceedingly guilty of hubris or chutzpah to think that we had gone beyond epidemics. What is extraordinary is that the government's inaction in the face of this epidemic is
extraordinary. I think you put your finger on exactly why I do then make the comparison with the Holocaust, because I do think that the inaction of Ronald Reagan and the intentional conscious actions of the right wing are indeed conscious motivations and not dissimilar to what Hitler did, i.e. perpetrated genocide. I think that they know this is going on and they want it to happen, and therefore science and research will not be attended to while this man is president of the United States.
I think many people are trying to put the AIDS epidemic into some context of something they've experienced in the past or know something about to help them better understand it. There's an article in the Village Voice this week in which Richard Goldstein calls AIDS this generation's Vietnam War because of the political lines that it's drawing and because of the effect it's having on consciousness and how people are living their lives. And I wonder what you think of that.
I don't think it's I don't think you can compare it with anything, and I don't know why we always have to compare everything with something. It is a very complicated issue. It's exceedingly difficult to make this issue comprehensible to the average layman.
I want to go back to something that Larry said, which I don't agree with. I think to label the right as being responsible for not being very helpful. I don't find the left any more helpful. I don't find any group.
Indeed, I do agree with that.
I really feel this cuts across every kind of issue.
When you have a man like Ted Kennedy, who is in charge of the Senate's Health Committee, has yet to speak out publicly in 7 years to take a courageous stand. When we have our own two senators, D'Amato and Moynihan. Moynihan, you're big liberal. I agree with you completely on that.
As the disease spreads, do you find people becoming more understanding about it?
There's polarization. There's more polarization than I thought. On one hand, I think there are more people who are understanding. On the other hand, I'm surprised at the hatred of gay people and people with AIDS in this country. Both. I feel both things very strongly
hatred
in my travel.
Hatred by the gay people.
Hatred by gay and straight people of gays and people with AIDS. There's a lot of
that's
hatred.
That's interesting. Yeah.
There's a strong polarization. There aren't too many people who are in between. There are people who have strong feelings on it. And I think, by and large, the country has been very understanding, surprisingly understanding. And that's a measure of the strength of goodwill and democracy in this country. On the other hand, there are strong forces of hatred that have to be combated. I think the people understand this epidemic much better than our leadership. Our leadership has been terrible and should follow the lead of the people of the country.
I don't know if you'll think this is a fair question or not, but because, I think gays and straights alike are changing their sexual behavior. Since so much of being gay is a function of your sexual persuasion, right? Do you think that gay identity, what it means to be gay now, is being altered in a way by the AIDS epidemic, and how people are defining themselves as gay? Is that being changed?
I think these
at all?
Distinctions have always been puerile. I think they've always been
which distinctions
between gay and straight and gay have been totally puerile. I have to say that to begin with. And I'm glad to see that people are modifying their behavior so they don't get AIDS. But I think the image of gay as of this horny bunch of people is really absurd. Gay has been just as much small town. Most gay lives are very boring. Sex lives are very boring and have always been and always will be. And what has changed is the inner city ghetto kind of image that was foisted to us by gay and straight media hype. Like the swinging gay image is changing.
I think it's also forcing us to try and identify, which pleases me enormously, to try and identify ourselves as something much greater than what we do with our genitals, and that we do have an amazing culture with many, many famous people out there, and that we now have to study that culture as women have learned to study their culture and as blacks have learned to study their culture and to identify who was in that culture and to get pride from that, you know. Not only actors like Montgomery Clifton and Rock Hudson, but great writers like Proust and Henry James and great economists and great statesmen and presidents of the United States all of this.
I feel that it's important to identify these things, but I can't wait to get – it's not in my lifetime, but I think it's ultimately stupid, these distinctions. I feel that it's a necessary – stage in our history to distinguish between gay and straight, and we have to go through it, and I'm willing to do it, but I really hate it, basically. I really am sick of it. I think it's stupid to
distinguish people. I disagree with you there. I'm enormously proud of being gay and want that culture to be strong and
on that note, we're out of time. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Thanks for being here. My guests have been William Hoffman and Larry Kramer. Kramer wrote the play The Normal Heart.
We're really good friends.
Yes.
And Hoffman wrote the play As Is, and they were two of the first and two of the most highly regarded plays about AIDS. This is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with composer John Morris. He's collaborated with Mel Brooks on the scores for the films Blazing Saddles, the producer's High Anxiety, and the new film Spaceball, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from listeners of WHYY. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, film director Jill Godmillow talks about bringing the stories of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas to the screen. Also, we'll hear from wandering folk singer Michael Cooney. He paused in his travels long enough to play us a couple of old favorites. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, reviews Talk Radio, Eric Bogosian's play about a Cleveland shock jock, and we'll have a news update from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Every week we invite a musician onto Fresh Air to play us a song or two. Today we welcome back folk singer Michael Cooney. He's known for keeping thousands of relatively unknown songs alive, like old blues tunes, maritime ballads, and children's songs. He's also known for his fresh interpretations of some very familiar tunes.
Here's a couple of old pop songs from the 1920s. I lived in Canada for the last 10 years, and I learned this one because I felt I ought to learn a French song.
Wonderful, it's wonderful to be in love with you. Beautiful, you're so beautiful. You haunt me all day through. Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise?
Now, I bet you didn't recognize that song until you heard the main part of it. A lot of these old songs have wonderful introductory verses that never make it onto the record, or especially not onto the sheet music. And I'd like to sing another song that I think is a beautiful song. And when I finally saw the verses that you will never find, I realized that the song said a whole lot more than just the soft shoe song and dance that most versions imply.
Shades of night are falling and I'm lonely, standing on the corner feeling blue. Sweethearts out for fun, pass me one by one. Guess I'll wind up like I always do, with only me and my shadow. Strolling down the avenue, me and my shadow, not a soul to tell our troubles to. When I go out at night with my old pal, we never fight about any gal, not me and my shadow, all alone and feeling blue. When the sun sets on the far horizon and the parlor lamps begin to glow, Jim and Jack and John put their slippers on. They're all set, but we're still on the go. So lonely, me and my shadow, strolling down the avenue. Me and my shadow, all alone without a thing to do. And when it's 12 o'clock, we climb the stairs. We never knock, for nobody's there. Just me and my shadow, all alone and feeling blue. Just me and my shadow, all alone and feeling blue.
Folk singer Michael Cooney is based in Richmond, Indiana. He'll be back on future editions of our program. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Jill Godmillow. She's best known for her documentary film Antonia, Portrait of a Woman, which she co-directed with Judy Collins. Her first feature film is called Waiting for the Moon. It's the next presentation of American Playhouse on PBS. It's based on the lifelong relationship between Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. In the style of Stein's own writing, the film sets out to invent what might have happened between Stein and Toklas during the summer of 1936. Godmillow told me why she wanted to make a film about Gertrude Stein.
I'm a big Stein fan. I've read her for years and years and years. I think she's, I would go so far as to say she's, for me, the most important innovator in the English language in the 20th century. I think everyone who's writing today in anything close to postmodernist is really in her legacy. And she's the one who opened the language, who really changed the way you could write. So there was always that. Then there was a strong fascination with the life, the living. In some way, they were the first Bohemians. And I think that in particular the thing about that was that she so unabashedly and with such good humor, with no announcements or labels of the life she chose to lead, lived it to the fullest extent, happily in a single relationship with another woman. with no fanfare and no urgency and no guilt and no statements to be made, just chose a life and lived it well. And that's pretty unusual.
Did you read a lot of Gertrude Stein's work in preparation for doing the movie?
I reread everything. And in fact, the film was not researched at all beyond reading Stein. We weren't interested in secondary sources or what so-and-so said about her.
Most of the incidents in the film are invented. The main characters are based on the real Stein and the real Toklas, but the incidents right. that you've given them are, for the most part, fictionalized. Why did you want to make up the incidents, just totally make them up for the movie?
That's a good question, because, in fact, it never occurred to us to do the other, which is the traditional, the biography, the docudrama. And we wanted to make a film that took its meaning not from the record, but because it had a proposition to make. It said, could this be Gertrude and Alice? Is this what they would have been like if this happened to them? And so it was never in our thoughts to remake Gertrude Stein in cinema. I think cinema and history are completely enemies. As soon as you cast a Linda Hunt for an Alice B. Toklas, you're outside of history. And as soon as you decide it's 90 minutes and it needs a beginning, middle, and end, you're outside of history. You've narrativized something that was not narrative.
Usually in a film about famous people, the more famous actor or actress plays the more famous person in the movie. Mm-hmm. And in this case, Linda Hunt, the more famous actress in the film, plays Alice B. Toklas, who's the less famous between Stein and, right. and Toklas. Right. How did she end up in that role?
Well, in truth, we offered her Gertrude first. We thought we had to cast a Gertrude first because it was the harder casting, given that that Gertrude Stein, much more than Alice, is sort of known photographically, and there is a certain cultural myth about her. Everybody has a few ideas about who this woman was. And Linda Hunt was my first choice. I couldn't imagine another American actress who I thought could play Gertrude Stein, that you'd buy it. And so we sent her the script, and she called immediately and said she was extremely interested in being in this movie and would meet with us. And she walked into the meeting, and her first words out of her mouth were, "You're not going to like this, but I want to play Alice." She had her good reasons.
What were those reasons?
She has played and been cast, for the most part, as what I call the other in cinema, that even though she's a woman, she has played the woman who is different than woman. And I'm talking about cinema language, now cultural language. She's, in fact, played a man. She's played a doctor in the Bostonians, the only woman in a Western town. In other words, smart woman or genius and all that is other in our society. And she was interested in playing the more feminine role, the wife role. It's something she had never had a chance to do. And I think just for career reasons, it was important for her to play a woman. There are very few roles for her in the cinema. And that's a statement about the American cinema. But she certainly can carry a feature film. But she had to, I think, show that she could play that as a woman, not as a freak.
How far along are you?
Don't get them out of order.
Why don't you just number the pages?
I will when I'm finished. If I number them now, you'll just want to add a page, and then I'll have to renumber everything.
What if they get misplaced?
They won't, unless you move them.
A gust of wind might sweep through.
One already has.
I'm not so sure about this part. What do you think?
We've been through this before. It's fine.
I'm tired of typing?
I don't mind typing. It's the retyping. One grows tired of seeing the same sentences pass by over and over again.
Art is a struggle for us all.
For some more than others.
Stein and Toklas were lovers, and that's pretty widely known. But you had to decide when you were directing the movie whether you'd have any sexual aspects of their relationship shown on screen. How did you decide to handle that?
There was a little bit of thinking and rethinking and rethinking about that. It's quite clear that there would be a desire on the part of the audience to have the nature of their sexual relationship, if there was any, confirmed by a gesture or a shot or a... And in fact, in cinema, that's very easy to do. One shot of the bed that has two depressions in it as opposed to one would have been a sign to the audiences, oh, yes, they sleep together. Therefore, I know who they are. They're lesbians, and therefore the film is about two lesbians. And therefore, the problems that they experience in the film are the problems of lesbians. And exactly for that reason, I refuse that gesture, and I refuse the kiss or the shot where both of them are in the same bed. It's a statement about our culture, really, that you can't make a film where you show two women in bed without the primary identity of those two women being lesbian, and it seemed exactly the wrong thing to do.
This is your first fiction feature film.
Right.
What kinds of new problems did it create for you? I don't mean disaster problems, but problems to solve as a filmmaker, things that you had to learn how to do that you didn't have to confront in documentaries.
I'd say it's completely different. The process is different. The biggest problem for me was there's no time to think. When you make a documentary, often you're able to raise some money, you shoot some, you look at what you've shot, you figure out what its meaning is, you raise some more money, you go in a different direction, you keep developing ideas, you keep developing structure as you go. And in dramatic film, there's this thing called the script, which is a model for the finished film. All the creative work is really done around that script and in the preparation of the shooting, in the casting and the choice of locations. And then it feels like finally the money's in place, finally everyone's assembled, bing, a gun goes off, and you go. And there's the schedule, and it says you shoot these three scenes this day, and you do. Because the actors are going home in 3 weeks, or because you have to, because there's no more money. And it's out of control. You're making myriad decisions every day that are intersecting at certain points, and you're not sure about any of them, but you've got to just keep making them. So it's radically different. And then suddenly it's over. That was pretty frightening, you know. I'm sure one gets to feel less overwhelmed by it, by, you know, the third, fourth, and fifth film. But that was quite a different experience than working and developing an idea through a documentary.
Do you plan on doing more feature films, fiction films?
Yeah, I'm up for some more. I've been trying to understand my own instinct to make more because it's kind of horrifying. It's not fun, really. Bergman used to check himself into a mental hospital after every film, and now I know why, you know. It's hair-raising. And that process and that schedule tends to make you want to not take the chances that you should take. I mean, it's very hard to do something radical in that production system. You suddenly understand why there are millions of hacks in the business and why you see film after film that looks like 10 films you've seen. To do the radical thing in that situation is very, very difficult.
Well, I wish you good luck and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Director Jill Godmilow's new film is Waiting for the Moon. It's the next feature on Public Television's American Playhouse series. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Well, we'll have a report on President Reagan's speech at the Berlin Wall. And we'll also have an interesting report about a recent study on black high school kids who think that academic achievement is acting white and therefore look down upon that sort of thing.
Well, the weekend's coming up, and I understand you're going to have some advice for sunbathers.
Yes, we will unravel the secrets of sun protection factors, the numbers on the sunscreens that you buy, which now range all the way up to about 29, I think, due to a recent FDA ruling.
I'm glad somebody knows what they mean. Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new kind of radio personality who's become popular by insulting and outraging listeners. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has just seen Eric Bogosian's new play, Talk Radio, about such a character.
Howard Stern is probably the most famous shock jock around these days, but there are guys just like him everywhere in the country. I mean guys. Shock jocks are male. They think aggression is virile, brave, and subversive. Lots of people listen to them. Lots of people also drink themselves to death. A Stern-type shock jock named Barry Champlain is the central character in Talk Radio, which recently opened at the Public Theater in New York. Eric Bogosian, who's been a performance artist for years, wrote and stars in the play. In his solo work, Bogosian plays druggy rockers and urban barnacles. They're high and hysterical, and Barry is definitely kin. But he's Bogosian's fullest portrait, and Talk Radio draws a graphic, gripping picture of the call-in scene. Barry's show, Night Talk, which broadcasts out of Cleveland, has just gone national. The sponsors are listening, and Barry is even more wired than usual. A caller says six words, and Barry jabs, "You're boring," and breaks the connection. The next caller uses the term third world, and Barry hammers him for a definition, tripping him up with irrelevancies and finally pulling the plug on him, too. A man who likes his cat is told, "Stop hanging around with pussy. Go find some." And when a pregnant 15-year-old starts to cry, Barry spits, "You like the feel of sex? You better like the feel of being pregnant. You seduced old Stan, and now you want people to feel sorry for you?" Some of Barry's lashings are so extreme they're funny. He tells a peace activist, "Nuclear war may be the best thing that ever happened to this country. It will wake some people up." And he enjoys baiting hate mongers as much as any other prey. He tells an anti-Semite a maudlin, obviously bogus tale about going to Dachau and finding a child's Jewish star, and he taunts a man for beating his kids. When this caller threatens to kill him, fear flickers across Barry's features. But mostly he's hard. He has no vision or politics. He's committed to promoting his ego and flashing rage. When he pulls the plug on callers, it's like committing a little murder, and as the evening wears on, he gets more and more sadistic. He boasts, "This decadent country needs my voice," and we see he really believes it. He's also forced to acknowledge that his audience is mainly desperate, lonely, and marginal. These are the people who respond to him, and as he recognizes his own smallness in them, he goes wild. He does the same thing every night. He hates himself, he spews poison, and he learns nothing. Bogosian's psychological portrait is astute. His performance is keen. With his rubbery face and curly mop of hair, he looks like a Marx brother on a bad trip. Soon, Bogosian will have a national audience. In August, PBS will broadcast one of his pieces, Funhouse, and in November, HBO will air a new work, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. But there's a problem with talk radio, as with other writing by Bogosian and much performance art in general. It's pretentious. It asks us to accept as social commentary merely a representation of reality. Bogosian sets up shock radio as a symbol of, drumroll, our times. I don't buy it. Shock radio is only a part of our times, and it's a moot question whether bigotry is on the rise or whether it is being expressed more openly. Saying the culture is diseased is a fix of pseudo-consciousness. All it does is let people clear their palates of discontent so they can consume more self-pity.
Laurie Stone reviewed Talk Radio. She's a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Tom Boswell, sports writer and columnist for The Washington Post. His new book, Strokes of Genius, explains why he loves the game of golf. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review a new album by alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, who's made a new life since kicking drugs and getting released from prison. And television critic David Bianculli looks back on 20 years of On the Road with Charles Kuralt. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Today's show was directed by Chris Bergen and Danny Miller. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Thank you. This is NPR, National Public Radio.